friends, I am Vivian McPeak, and this is Hempresent. If you have feedback or would like to suggest a guest or topic for Hempresent, email me at hempresent@gmail.com. Bishop Ivy Gaines was released from federal custody in March of 2021 after serving 20 years of a 183-year sentence. Bishop studied law for 18 and a half of those years, using what he learned to free others and finally himself. He is the founder and designer of the Mentor Program, Men Teaching Others Responsibility, that he has delivered at six prisons over 11 years, and he's expanded his impact to nurture systemic change within the Seattle, Washington community. Today, as founder and president of Mentor Seattle, Bishop invites key community contributors and agencies of authority to build a path forward and reestablish community trust. Since 2022, he's designed and delivered several innovative programs in collaboration with local organizations, pursuing meaningful changes in the relationship between law enforcement and the community. I've invited him here today for a discussion on his life, his mission, and the impact of his work. Welcome, Bishop, to Cannabis Radio.
Welcome, welcome. Hey, you, I might want to hire you to do my intro. That was pretty good. Wow.
I work cheap, man.
Right, man. That sounds so much better coming from you than me, I tell you.
So, Bishop, you know, there's so much to talk about. You spent decades in prison, serving 20 years of a 183-year sentence. I can't even imagine what that's like. Currently, 20% of America's released prisoners commit a new violent offense in the first 3 years after their release. Before we get into your programs and stuff, can you talk about those years you spent inside and give us your thoughts on this country's approach to criminal justice in general?
Well, I think there's a strong distinction between restorative and retributive justice. That's probably another podcast in and of itself. But my particular sentence was so lengthy because the government, we're gonna be nice, we're gonna say that they misinterpreted the 924C classification of statute itself. And so instead of applying it the way that the Congress would have meant for it to be applied, they misapplied it for over 25, 30 years. I just happened to be one of those people who were caught up in that misinterpretation of the law. And in 2018, when Congress clarified how they originally intended that particular statute to be applied, was when I acted to see if I could free myself from that sentence. As it relates to the criminal system itself, it's interesting to know that a people would not be aware that their most traumatized people are being thrown into prison as if that's going to be the answer to our challenges.
Right.
That we don't know better.
You mentioned restorative versus retributive justice. Is that basically saying rehabilitation versus punishment?
Absolutely. So we punish people for, because the classification of the statute implies that they knowingly committed the offense. Well, I'm not sure that actually applies to any and or all, right? So across the board, I don't know that knowing is the key point, because it implies much and more about what the person knew was going to take place if they were to do this or that thing. So
there's a whole lot of the story not being told in that, right?
That's a whole lot of the story not being told right there. When you get into the knowledge of a thing, you're really, really suggesting that person had one, the cognitive skill, and two, some sort of crystal ball as to what the outcome may or may not have been. So,
right.
Yeah, it's interesting the way that we've written the laws.
You devoted much of your time studying law while you're incarcerated. Had you at that time had any formal training in the law, or was that a total learning experience for you? And what is studying law like while in prison?
I mean, it was absolutely desperation. You can only imagine what a first-time offender does when he looks at 183 years. I had no criminal record at the time. And so that kind of sentence for the first time at 38 years old, for me, with a daughter that was nine, a son who was just about to graduate high school, my back was up against it, I can say, for lack of a better term or phrase. So when I started studying law, it was because I promised my daughter that daddy would come home, and I wanted to be able to keep that promise. I got denied, consequently, 19 times in an attempt to free myself up until 2018, of course. But studying law in the law library at the prison, I had to be the law clerk in order to do that. So I have to pass some requisite courses, get a certificate. And then I was allowed to study the code books at the time because we didn't have computers inside. You know, we're talking about level 7 prisons, that's USPs. And so there's not a lot there. So I was forced to study all 50 code books in an effort to begin to learn what I didn't know. It was long, it was hard, it was arduous, it was sleepless, it was scary, but it was needful. And so
it was freedom.
The only thing that right. I could do, right? It was freedom. The only thing, in fact, I think I might've been more free, and I've said this a dozen times, I think I might've been more free, well, you know, of course, in comparison to today. But while I was incarcerated, I think I found myself free for the first time in my entire life. It was amazing when
in the mind?
Absolutely. I mean, I began to look at the world and what my life would have been were I not to have been arrested, where I might have been, might not have been here. And so it disrupted that behavior and allowed me the opportunity to reset. I'm not sure many people are going to give themselves 20 years to reset. So,
right, yeah. Right. Albeit a forced reset, but as I said, I want to dive into the innovative programs and the work that you've been doing, especially in the second segment. But before we do, at what point did you decide that you would distill all of your experiences and knowledge you gained in the criminal justice system into positive change in the lives of others? Was there an event that inspired you, or was it more of a process?
Absolutely. There was a single event there. I was transferred from 6 institutions over the course of the time that I was incarcerated. And always because they said that I fit a criteria for quintessential perfect inmate. I came out of federal custody in level 7 prisons without any shots. And by that, I mean no infractions, no inductions, no fights, no this, that, no that. I didn't even join a gang. But it happened because I began to, as I'm studying law, it was necessary for me to study the program statement for the BOP. And as I was studying the program statement, I found a provision in the dialogue of the program statement that allowed for prisoners to create organizations. I was just trying to think of the code name, but it escapes me at the moment. But anyway, it required that I create a board of directors. It required that I perform meetings in a particular fashion. It needed a program statement, a general statement, duties and responsibilities, ethics, et cetera. So I went about writing and building this entity, this organization, right, inside prison. And then once it was approved by the warden, my last goal was to create content. So I was in the challenge program at the time, which is one of the 304 evidence-based recidivism-reducing programs that the BOP has adopted over the last 20 years. And so I graduated the challenge program, became a mentor there for 5 years. And as a byproduct of Dr. Dunstan's influence, I began to take what I was learning and looked at the inmate population and asked myself, how do I get them to see that this is the best thing for us? Violence was really, really high, as you can imagine. And over the course of the time that I was in prison, I think when I left Pollock USP, we had reduced violence by 17%. Wow. Because of the programs we were operating.
That's impressive. That's results.
Yeah, that's results. And of course, I'm a byproduct of that learning and that application. And so I'm kind of the living example of what it means to be reformed.
And of course, the backdrop of all of this is that communities of color have been vastly disproportionately targeted and prosecuted and incarcerated in this country.
Absolutely. And so what I was seeing was that the African-American community that I belong to, I was looking at my comrades and I was noticing a through thread in each of them. And that was that the only thing that they were lacking, it wasn't drive, it wasn't creativity, it wasn't motivation, because all of the crimes that they committed were definitely motivated and all of the other things that it would take for anyone to be successful. So they had all of the transferable skills they needed to move into a new direction. They just didn't have the information. So they didn't have knowledge, right? They didn't have training. They didn't understand. And so all I thought my job was to do was to encourage them, to show them, to demonstrate to them that they had options and why, to show them where their power center was and ask them to reconsider giving it away or just dispensing it as if it wasn't valuable. And it actually worked.
I'm speaking to Bishop Ivy Gaines. We're going to take a quick break and come back with our second segment and dive into the programs.
Time to roll out for the people that let us hemp present. Hang loose. We're coming right back.
And we're back with Bishop Gaines. Bishop, you have operated the mentor program, I think it's in six prisons. Is that right?
Absolutely. Six prisons. And I believe last I checked, it's still active in one or two.
Can you describe the program, including its goals, how it works, and how participants have responded?
When I left POLOC, USP in 2021, we had upwards of 65 members in the challenge program on that particular compound. Over the course of the time that I was in prison, I had created six or seven other programs and left them behind at other institutions. But I'm mostly proud of this one because the acronym there is Men Teaching Others Responsibility. And so I was able to handpick some men that were looking to promote change first within themselves and then to watch it transform other lives. We formed a board and we sought out, or our mission was to educate those who were soon to be released from prison in what it was going to take, what it means, what freedom actually was, and how to cherish and flourish in society instead of the robber baron mentality that we once had.
Bishop, you, and I quote, work in collaboration with local organizations pursuing meaningful changes in the relationship between law enforcement and the community, end quote. I participated in a roundtable discussion called The Barbershop, led by you, that included current members of law enforcement, new recruits, and community members. You work with the Seattle Police Department and the King County Sheriff's Office to conduct the workshops every 4 to 6 weeks with their new recruits before they attend their tactical training at the police academy.
Yes.
Your stated goal is to rebuild community trust with law enforcement. Can you talk about that program? What inspired you to launch it? And what was the process like of convincing law enforcement to participate in a program run by someone that was just in prison?
Right. Imagine the uphill climb.
Right.
To obtain something as rich and
Give
rewarding
me access
as where
to your
we
people.
Find our right, exactly where we find ourselves today. Right. So it's like the construct had orchestrated some very specific events to take place. There was a SPD lieutenant that was retiring who was a friend of a friend who had sponsored the Before the Badge program for Seattle PD, who needed a facilitator to come in at the end of one of their sessions. They asked me.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting six crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus four biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
And, excuse me, they asked my organization I was with at the time, and the organization said, hey, well, let me ask one of our facilitators, the designers, whether he or she might be willing. And so Kathy and I, who you met at the workshop, we did the first several Before the Badge programs for Seattle PD. Now, the hook there was that I never told anyone about my history until after the program was over, right? Mm-hmm. So because of the implicit bias issue, it struck me that that would be an interesting point because what they thought they were engaging with was someone from the community. They thought they were engaging with someone who was maybe even a philanthropist or someone who had made a career of public speaking, et cetera, right? What they found was my full story at the end and the look on their faces, the shock of that taking place right at the end was worth its weight in gold. But how we got there was like breadcrumbs, following breadcrumbs. I, I began to realize that I myself had a fear of the uniform. I had a fear deeply ingrained, and that's another show, about slave catchers and police, right? And so I knew I had to do something about that in order to stay in the room and remove that fear from being in the room with those men and women who were seeking that career. And so what I started doing, and you're going to laugh about this, I started pulling police officers over. I don't know about you, but I don't necessarily like my mind to be challenged with fear. So when I see it, I no longer lie to myself. So I remember the day that I got the nerve to walk up to my very first police officer. I was at IHOP in Capitol Hill. And I was having breakfast with a friend one morning around 6 a.m. And there was 2 King County sheriffs behind me at the table. So for about, 20 minutes or so, I wrestled with myself inside, finally got the nerve to stand up, walked over, introduced myself. That conversation, 45 minutes later, elicited an invitation to come back and have lunch with them on a regular basis. Every Sunday, we would meet there. And I used to call it the barbershop because that's what I did when I was inside. The barbershop program was something I did inside where I selected key members of gangs to come together to the challenge program. And we began to talk about the really hard subjects, like when did telling the truth become hot? When did it become wrong for me to tell the truth, right? We're kind of undressing that elephant in the room. And so we started having those kinds of conversations. And that's how we reduce violence. And so when I began to have these conversations with these few officers who would meet there every Sunday, they welcomed me into this group. And that birthed the opportunity for me to be present at one of their graduations. And at the graduation, they introduced me to the King County Sheriff herself. That led her to be interested in coming to one of the programs. And here we are, 2.5 years later. Amazing.
Everything's about relationships, right?
It is. And I've been saying that for years. I'm absolutely convinced that influence is the new currency, and it's all about relationships.
You know, I can kind of in my own way relate to your experiences, because as you know, I ran the Seattle Hemp Fest for 28 years, 100,000 people coming out to protest cannabis laws. And in the process, I had to work with members of the Special Events Committee and, you know, Seattle Police Department, Port of Seattle Police Department directly. And I had the same experience where I was extremely intimidated by cops in general, as, you know, a young hippie pot smoker type California guy most of my life. And over the process of the years of working directly with the police department, with members of the police that did events on the planning stage and the executing the event in the field, we formed incredible relationships, and they came to really respect and like us because, regardless of their politics and our politics, they saw that we were genuine, we were responsible, and that we were, you know, that if we said something was going to happen, it happened the way we said it was going to happen, when it was going to happen.
Absolutely.
And towards the end, I'm just going to say, wrap up, towards the end at these meetings with 20 different departments, it was the police that were always defending us. And it took years to get to that point. Who would ever imagine that?
Who would ever? Listen, I'm not laughing at you. I'm laughing with you. Because I had an occasion recently when I did my transfer, when I transitioned from the organization I was working with to my own company now, it happened that law enforcement agencies in this region came to my defense and rallied around me so that we could continue the programs that we presently have in place. It was absolutely amazing. And here's why I think it happened. I somehow made, well, not somehow. When I, to get over my fear, I started from that particular point of standing up and going next to the table next to me and introducing myself. That process led me into randomly, when I would see officers pulled over, parked in different places, having lunch or doing paperwork, whatever, I would make it a point to stop. I say now, in jokingly, that I pull cops over all the time. I do. I pull right up to them, right? I got business cards in my pocket. They're public servants. Let's have a conversation, right? So I engage and I collect their names, their business cards, and I've got all of this vast community now of law enforcement professionals who I can see as human beings. I can make a distinction between, thankfully, between the agency and the human being that wears the uniform.
Right.
Do you see that? How important that is? I'm not saying that any of us are perfect, because we're not. I'm not giving license, and I'm not supporting ill actions and et cetera, though that's another conversation. But as far as the doctor's uniform that he wears and his white coat and his scrubs and the uniform that the officer wears, I've got all of that under professionals, right? Under the auspice of professionals. And I can make a distinction between the person that's operating within that profession and my responsibility to the human family.
We'll take a quick break, come back with our final segment with Bishop Ivy Gaines.
Time to roll out for the people that let us hemp present. Hang loose. We're coming right back.
We're back for our final segment with Bishop Gaines. You know, Bishop, you're talking about your experience with these. Well, you're talking about your profile on the cops, right?
Right, exactly, right? Give it back, right? Because, I mean, I'm a community member. I'm entitled to do that, right?
That's
the lion's
right.
share
that's
responsibilities
right.
on my shoulders anyway, right? Yeah.
That's right,
yeah.
man.
I know who I am now, right? And that's interesting.
I used to tell, you know, I used to stand up on the Hemp Fest stage, right? To, like, you know, 10, 15, 20, 30, 40,000 people in front of me. And say the police are not our enemy. And it was real controversial, you know. And I said, look, you know, every stoner's not my brother and every cop's not, you know, my enemy. That every individual
right.
needs to be taken at on their own merit, as you know, one at a time.
Right.
You know, whether regardless of what their cultural trappings or their uniform or anything like that is.
Right.
And over the years, you know, that really served the purpose. Bishop, there's a lot of issues surrounding crime, law enforcement, and the state of incarceration in America, and things kind of boiled to the surface in recent years with the Black Lives Matter movement. By the way, I think that's like one of the most brilliant slogans I've ever heard. Then it kind of morphed into the defund the police movement, which I think is one of the worst slogans I ever heard. And other issues like qualified immunity for police. And I just kind of want to open things up for you while we have some time to share your thoughts on what we can all do to bring these factions together and try to bridge some of the divide that's clearly harming our communities. And you know, specifically costing the lives of young men of color in particular. What can the average
Absolutely.
Person do?
Well, here's qualified immunity, mass incarceration, systemic racism, other things. Listen, I think it boils down to the fact that law enforcement is not going anywhere. Crime is not going anywhere. Policing is two things, policy and training. So the barbershop workshops are specifically designed for community members to come, share their voice with these new cadets before they go to law and tactical so that we can influence them in the importance of guardianship in our communities and not warriors. We make sure that we leave them with the message that you cannot set up war against a community, can't win that fight. And so if we're going to move the needle forward together, we have to do it together. And that's going to require some accountability. So on the part of community, when they engage with law enforcement, on the part of law enforcement, when they engage with community, right? So everyone has to put down their picks, their knives, their pitchforks, right? We have to put that down for a time. And we have to look at what's taking place right now. Can't look back. Got to look forward, right? Can't look in the rearview mirror. Got to look forward, right? We can't take that with us, right? That, yes, those things happen perfect. Not discounting that. Just let's move the needle. Because if we don't, we're going to be looking at circumstances that we're going to really, really be ashamed of. And we have to remember that the next generation is watching. You look at the crime rate now with the young people. I go into the JDC, which is a juvenile detention center, and do a workshop there every month. And I tell those young men, that it's my fault, my generation, that they're where they are. We dropped the ball on them, right? We gave them false information and we left them at a critical time when they needed us. And this is what has become of our world. And so men of color and men of the human family, let's come together. And women of the nurturing ilk, let's work together to rebuild our community. It's us, we have to do it. We can't wait for anyone else. Law enforcement will stand there and wait for time and season to intercede. But if we get our hands and dirty, right, it'll be because we're working for our future together.
And a lot of it's just economics and lack of opportunity, right? And if somebody has no opportunity, they'll create their own opportunity.
Absolutely. And so in the absence of information, in the absence of opportunity, you know, they're going to look around their environment. And if that environment is predominantly criminal or based or, any of those terms, then I mean, it's where we're adaptable, right? That 0 to 5, 5 just before double digits. These are our informative years. And so I can't blame these young men for being where they are. They're where they are because they didn't have the
that's right.
Primary caregiver.
They didn't have the nurturing. They didn't have the mentorship.
Absolutely. They missed all that. And so now my aim is to give them back some of those, what the gaps in their lives have brought to them, right? Show them, one, that there's a gap there, and then help them fill it with something. I tell the guys all the time, all we have to do is help you find what you love. And by that, I mean what you would do for free for the rest of your life without being paid. That is what you love. That is where you're going to thrive. Be amazed to see them.
Go ahead.
You'll be amazed to see them not have ever thought about that before. So it's ongoing work, but I'm really proud of it.
As you should be. We have run out of time, Bishop. Real quickly, is there a way that people can support and follow your efforts?
Absolutely. If you need to get in touch with me, it is mentorseattle@gmail.com is the email. And you can look forward to our website being available within the next couple of weeks, and also a YouTube channel that we're establishing in the next 48 hours. So more to come from Bishop and Mentor Seattle.
And Mentor is MENTPOR, right?
Yes.
All right. Bishop Abigail, thank you so much for your important work in our community, and thanks for being on my show, man.
Thank you, my friend. Appreciate you. See you soon.
All right. That concludes this installment of Hemp Zone on Cannabis Radio. When it comes to prohibition, you've got the right not to remain silent. Activism requires a voice, so find your voice and speak up for justice, because resistance is fertile. The Hemp Zone intro music is 7 Mile Beach by Joanne Rand, and the outro music is Take Back the Plant by Stickerbush. See you next time. Stay strong. Marijuana!